Conversations with Strangers. I could begin this story with Jesus' invitation to invite the little and the leper and the least and the lame to a common table. Or his promise that we meet him in the face of strangers. Whatever you did for one of the least, you did for me. Or I suppose I could begin with the words of the Hebrew writer intimating that entertaining strangers unknowingly led to mysterious encounters with God's messengers. But I begin the story of the Speedway Church of Christ's attempts to recover a missional orientation to the other with the closing of the McKinney family grocery store. The collapse of the local groceries in the wake of more efficient supermarkets in the middle of the 20th century is almost a tired metaphor for the erosion of community caused by modernity. But in the Speedway Church's life, nothing could have been more true. My congregation was started by countercultural blue-collar people, Scotch-Irish and German mostly. It was founded in 1885 on Blaine Avenue, on the west side of Indianapolis. The dominant elder owned and operated a grocery. It was the hub of the neighborhood. People, down on their luck, the church used to say, would come into the store and find work and a temporary place to live in an apartment above the store or in the McKinney family's basement. Regular hospitality, food, family, shelter, work, and church were offered to those who wanted a fresh start. But the store was closed in the late 50s, and the neighborhood declined, and my church moved to Speedway. For over 20 years, nobody in the congregation lived in this new part of town. People drove out from the inner city or in from the suburbs to the insular town on the outskirts of Indianapolis. But the connection, you see, between church and neighborhood had been broken. Mission had been ripped from a sense of place. While we never would have admitted it, the church had become a simple liturgical club for more mobile members. Hospitality had been moved into private homes. And like Christine Pohl has noted, hospitality was more likely to reinforce social distinctions than to undermine them. And so in the wake of the closing of the McKinney grocery store, and in the generation after that, we lost something. And only gradually did we begin to see what it was that we lost. Only gradually did we begin to change. A few years ago, we did start a community development project at church, started hosting some community meals, built a community center, started an after-school art program, and began to engage, in modest ways, with the church's location. Last fall, the Wednesday night groups consciously voiced that our sense of identity was leading us into the community more and more, and I started talking to more of our members about our call to be sent into the communities in which we live and witness and work. I didn't understand how uneasy my church members were. I picked four ladies to help the church think about how to be more mission-minded this January. They all knew each other and had agreed to interview some outsiders about their feelings about church and neighborhood. We were trying to follow God's leading by listening to the stranger. All of these would-be interviewers were my buddies, but not always in the thick of things at church, all of them with fears I had not fully felt. Two of the gals live on the Alton Project, a group of houses my church has renovated in a marginal neighborhood on Indianapolis's west side. Cindy Lester Smith is closing in on retirement age. In fact, she already draws some retirement and works part-time at Crestwood Village, a retirement community with various levels of in-home care. She came to Speedway nearly 2 years ago, not yet willing to accept that she was going through a divorce. We helped her transition out of her abusive marriage, and we ministered to her son, and in the process we became dear to one another. The Alton Project gives her and her current husband a sense of ministerial purpose, a holy challenge to help people and place. Cindy does some fretting about the security around Alton. Many of the neighbors know she's working with the church, and they come to her for aid, sometimes at odd hours, looking for financial assistance, which Cindy is learning not to give. When I moved Cindy into the neighborhood, I wanted her to get to know people for their sake. But as it turns out, developing some dependable relationships has become far more important for her own sense of safety. Brenda Carter is a 6'1 lady, a retired correctional officer who spent over 20 years working for the Illinois Department of Corrections. She lives 80 yards east of Cindy on Berwick and 11th. She moved to Indy to care for her son Woody, who lives a couple blocks north. Woody had an accident that left his brain function marginally impaired, and Brenda finds meaning looking after a lot of people like him. She happened onto our church when we were serving Thanksgiving meals one November about 7 years ago, and I asked her if she would like to help us take meals to the people she knew. She jumped at the idea. I got to know her son, Woody, eating Thanksgiving meals with him in the community center, and after a year of bringing Woody to church and leaving and coming back, Brenda just started staying through church on Sundays. Now we can't do without her. She's not impressed with a lot of my talk, certainly not with my historicism that dodges the command to give holy kisses, and she greets me with exaggerated smooches on both cheeks many Sundays just to see if she can get my goat. She, more than Cindy, is used to living in places like Alton, where most of the people do not own their homes. Yet when it came time for our group to meet our first Thursday night in January, Brenda called me up an hour before time to say that she wouldn't make it. She was taking somebody to get their car fixed. I wanted to get mad at her for serving in the community instead of just talking about serving with me. Perhaps, then, that's part of what we needed to learn from Brenda. While talking together is an important practice, for Brenda, actions matter most. Woody is fond of encouraging me as I take the pulpit.
No pressure, preacher! No pressure!
But Brenda is under pressure, especially trying to care for Woody. I was sad she wouldn't be with us in our sessions. She represents the most experience in an Alton kind of neighborhood. I'd no sooner told Cindy that Brenda was not coming when Betty Hunt walked up on the front porch and said, "Knock, knock!" Betty, at 76, still towers over her world at 4'11" tall. She's a bit proud of all the people she could drub at tennis before the joints became too inflamed to go on playing. In her Lauren Bacall-like voice, she informed me of some of the intricacies of the latest Bronco playoff game. I told her I had one pod of decaf coffee left. If you want me to make it, yes, she told me without hesitation. And when I came back down a couple minutes later, having broken the coffee pod that I used to make the coffee, she asked, "What is that?" "Well, Betty, it's coffee. I understand if you don't want to drink it." She took it and gulped a bit. "Not bad if you chew it," she said to the laughter of the other women who had arrived. "Kent, what did you do?" my wife worried from the kitchen. "I got coffee grounds in the coffee, hon. Here, let me strain it in the kitchen. I took Betty's cup as she winked at the other ladies. As my first act of discernment, I want to make sure that whatever we do for the community, we should not have Kent serve them coffee, I heard Betty chuckling from the kitchen. Towards the end of the evening, she made a point of drinking the cup dry and handing it to me, saying, "It's the best cup I ever had." I first knew Betty as the grandmother of the girlfriend my then 16-year-old son Quentin was dating. She chaperoned the two of them a good bit during 2011. But when my boy and her granddaughter broke up, Quentin just kept calling Betty. She would listen to him rant for hours. She'd take him to dinner, spoil him in ways that concerned me. The relationship was a bit strange, yet I was relieved after I started having coffee with Betty every now and then myself. This stranger was helping me raise my son. Soon, high school kids, mostly Quentin's friends, my son's friends, started gathering at her house on Friday nights. By the time Quentin was a junior in high school, he brought Betty to church. At a recent testimonial service, Betty recalled, "I started meeting with Quentin because I thought I was doing it for him," she said. "But now I know that it was me who needed this church." All of my ladies understand something of this reversal where hosts end up hosted. Perhaps that's one reason why I selected them. I had an intuitive feeling they understand the idea of going into the community as the community's guests, that they could recognize that the key to kingdom growth often lies within the resources of the stranger, herself. Lene Gilmore, a single African-American woman in her 30s, came to the Speedway Church for the first time this summer. She worries about visiting in new places because she has so many food allergies she can't eat half of what's served, and she fears giving offense. She worries some about her oldest daughter, an undergraduate freshman this year, who does well academically, but, in her words, gets drawn into drama. She's a single mom who grew up watching her mother work with people in need, and she earns a living as a teacher's aide ministering to special needs students. Lene says she gets more from the needy children she works with every day than she gives them. She gets that ministry is often demonstrating an openness to the gifts of others. And so on Thursday, the third Thursday in January, after supper, I sat down with a retirement village worker, an elderly lady who hosts teenage parties at her house, and an aide to special needs children, to listen with each other for God's leading on how to engage the community. We dwelled in the Word, listening and being quiet over Luke 10, verses 1 through 12. Betty was the first to speak up. "I centered in on the fact that he sends us out as lambs among wolves." "Yeah," Cindy continued. "I've always remembered that the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. But being sent out vulnerably among wolves is the reason why there aren't very many, right?" She looked at me for approval. Betty said, "Well, I see the Bible saying that we should be humble, not abusive, and that makes us a lamb. But despite this, I feel safe and stronger than wolves because we have a future." "I don't feel safe," Lene said. Betty tried to encourage. "Well, we have to go two by two. We'll look out for each other, Lene, as we go together." "You get in front of me," Lene drew us into laughter. I tried to corral us all by asking Lene what part of the passage especially struck her. "Do not take sandals and do not greet anyone on the road," Lene stared intently down at the text in front of her, moving her hands up and down parallel as if doing some slow karate chops. Cindy jumped in before Lene's deliberate style moved us forward. "Yeah, me too, especially the part about not greeting anyone on the road." "I don't understand that," Lene concurred. Cindy wanted to know if you were supposed to be saving the world, why you would not greet people. "Why?" Lene looked at me as if I was supposed to have the definitive take on all such issues. Cindy rescued me. "And don't move around," she said. An ensuing pause was refreshing to me, and then Cindy, as if buoyed with new insight, "You know, he's worried about everybody getting jealous of the other person. Oh, he's staying with me." "Oh, no, I want him," Cindy said more confidently. "He didn't want a competition." Lene continued, "And when you go, you are to say, peace to this house. Carry your EpiPen because you have to eat what's there, Lene," Betty jibed. "Is there a cat under the table?" Lene asked. Theodore, the family cat, had rubbed up against her legs under the table. "I mean, he's a nice and everything, but I'm just allergic to cats." Trying to contain myself from Betty's joke, I put the cat into the basement and tried to draw us back to why the disciples should not greet others on the road. Betty then told Lene and Cindy that if they got to talking, that they might not ever get to where we were supposed to be. "Skip some conversations in order to get to the important ones. Maybe that's what he means." Cindy couldn't contain herself. "Why no purse or money?" "Well, you didn't bring anything over for supper tonight," I said. "When you go as a guest, you depend on the host to provide. If you paid for lodging, that makes the host no longer a host, but almost a kind of employee, and the power relations would have been inversed." Cindy's a little uncomfortable with my language. She asked if I was trying to say that Jesus wanted no distractions around the issue of money, and I tried to suggest that while that might have played a part in this picture, my point was that Jesus wanted the disciples to go as guests, knowing that they needed the people in the community more than the people in community needed them. Guests are dependent on the host's gifts. "We shouldn't go into neighborhoods as if we're going to fix them," I said. "We should go seeking to find their help, the neighborhood's help, to do whatever good we can accomplish together." "That instruction is really hard for me." "Not even a candy bar in your pocket," Cindy said. Betty chimed in. "You know, I didn't take it that way. I took it as like, here I am, I have nothing, and I'm not interested in anything, or make a big reputation." Cindy looked at Betty and I both. "Do you think it was hard for them to do that? To admit that they had all the connections and we had none?" "The part I settled on," Cindy said, "was do not move around from house to house." "Do you think that the reason they were not to move around from house to house was that they didn't want people getting jealous if they changed houses, as if they were trying to move up in accommodations or something? You can do too much. Maybe he wanted the disciples to go deeper with one set of people." Betty replied, "I think he did not want it to devolve into a competition for who could host the disciples, and then the people would become very wise to you and not trust that. Like, watch out for this clown." I told the ladies I was very pleased with the conversation, and that I felt it had set the stage for the kind of disposition we wanted to cultivate as we went into the neighborhoods as guests rather than being invitational ourselves. and I began to discuss the assignment I'd been given in class and the congregation's own reflections last fall that indicated that the Speedway Church was becoming more missional in its outlook. Yet, as I turned my attention to developing interview questions, I felt their anxiety getting thicker. Lene, usually quite confident, had a positive attitude, but I hypothesized that there was part of her that actually did seem like she wanted someone to get in front of her as she went out to ask these questions. It was as if she'd really have to take her EpiPen with her in fear of an allergic reaction from those she might interview. Cindy was worried about who she would choose to interview in the Alton neighborhood. There were people she didn't know well and she would like to interview. One lady she really enjoyed could only be interviewed through her 11-year-old daughter, who could translate English into Spanish and Spanish into English. Every potential interviewee presented an additional concern for Cindy, and Cindy's own security fears, I thought, were beginning to color her approach to all the questions. My first sample question that these interviewers could ask their strangers was something like, "What do you think the biggest strength and ultimately the biggest need is in this neighborhood?" That question was transformed by the group, who feared their interviewees were not particularly analytical. Instead, the question the ladies felt more comfortable asking became, "What would make you feel more comfortable or secure in this neighborhood or work setting?" I thought about challenging this, but Betty said something that stopped me in my tracks. "You know, I used to like to have trick-or-treaters, but any more kids come that are not masked and are twice my size and demanding candy, so I don't even turn my light on anymore." Lene nodded in agreement. "I don't let Kamari answer the door, and I have a baseball bat." Those two images, particularly Lene's baseball bat sitting next to the door, began to sink in. If I were going to ask these three ladies, two of them single, to help me do discernment, then I was going to have to get in touch with the way they felt. I had to come to terms with the fact that being male, living in a secure neighborhood in a visible location with other grown people in the same house, was obscuring my vision. My own prayerful time of dwelling in the Word had led me to the words, "Be sure of this, the kingdom of God is near." The need for assurance, both for my interviewing ladies and for the community as a whole, began to grip me. I enjoyed the feminine flavor of the group's second question. "Can you think of a time when you had warm feelings towards a church? Tell me about it." The third question was like it. "What is your best memory associated with a church?" Finally, we decided we would ask, "Was there ever a time when you felt that a neighborhood came together and felt closer?" Cindy anticipated that some of her neighbors might recall the block party we sponsored a year ago, adding that she was afraid of asking too many questions, fearing becoming intrusive. "I don't want to push it," she said. Lene said, "I feel strongly about those four questions we have." She pointed with four fingers and shook them up and down. Lene's words overcame my unspoken reservations about the questions steering the discussion towards security concerns, and as the ladies departed, I was thankful for what they were all doing. This was just slightly out of their comfort zone, yet Betty's words reassured me that they would be fine. "We may be sheep among wolves, but God keeps us safe." As we came together after church a week and a half later, we again read Luke 10:1-11, and Betty again went first, saying, "The word that comes to my mind in this passage is safe." "That was the theme with you last time, wasn't it?" I replied. Yeah, I can feel at peace even in somebody else's turf. Safe. Yes, peace, yes. But what I keep coming to, Lene added, is faith. Because if you do not have faith, these other things will not come. You'll not go out to others to begin with. I found it interesting that these ladies who, on the first occasion of dwelling in this text, had questions that drove them in numerous directions about the text, the second time around were more interested in summing up their experience with the text, about a week and a half later. My inner exegete wanted to point them to specific language, but I trusted these theologians who were summing up their life experience with the text. I wondered if their experience of conducting the interviews in light of that passage had something to do with it. And I asked, "So did you have your interviews?" Cindy saw what looked like a lengthy manuscript in Betty's hands and said, Betty has more writing than I do. Betty said, "I want to tell you about Olga." The oncologist said there's something in her chest that doesn't look good. She's 88 years old and ridding her house of everything. I started writing her answers down, but she said, "I'll write them down for you." So I'm reading her chicken scratches. To the first question about what would make her feel more comfortable, she wrote, "So far, I feel secure in my neighborhood." Betty looked up at us and explained, "You see, in our neighborhood, there are a lot of old people who kind of know each other, but not well. Friendly, but not social." I knew that Betty lived in the Brady Bunch section of Speedway that was built in the 1970s. Speedway is a town of about 6,000 residents surrounded by Indianapolis. It was founded in the 1920s near the racetrack. It boomed during World War II because the Allison Engine Company, located on the south side of town, built aircraft engines and employed largely blue-collar, predominantly Catholic and Orthodox workers from Eastern European neighborhoods on the greater west side. The Army Corps of Engineers built large stretches of the old town. The war generation, who built the south side, is largely now gone. And these neighborhoods are more diverse and young again. But the war generation's children built on the north side of town. Betty's neighborhood is less dense. Real estate values are higher, but it is still relatively homogeneous and now quite elderly. Betty continued with Olga's words about the last question. "We always come together to watch out for each other, and we call the police for one another." Betty looked up at me again and started exegeting her context. "You have to understand that Olga worked for the FBI. Second, if somebody walks down the street and just wanders a bit or so, or goes slow, the old people who are at home watching will call the police right away. They sit down on their front windows watching. I mean, really." Olga didn't like the look of someone one day, and she was edging the sidewalk, and she called me to say that she was going to go in and put her garage door down. "You watch him while I go and call for help." This wasn't altogether surprising to me, but I pressed Betty for what she thought of it. "Is Olga paranoid, or is she savvy? How is it that she can feel secure and at the same time be keeping such vigilant watch?" "Well, I must tell you," Betty said, "besides my ex-husband, Olga is the most negative person I've ever met. If someone shows up, she thinks he can't possibly be up to any good. With regard to a time when she had warm feelings for the church, she writes, 'I have many good memories from traveling. The many churches I visited, prayers, God, and Jesus are the true meaning.'" "It's frustrating to me," Betty said, "that while she's Catholic, she visits many different kinds of churches, and her fond memories are only from faraway places she's visited. She, however, does mention her childhood church. Betty struggled to read Olga's broken English. The church belonged to in my youth, where I learned about God and Jesus, makes a warm feeling, and Savior and heaven does exist for us. Sounds like she's got some basic things figured out in her head, Cindy said. Jesus is seldom mentioned. All the saints do everything with her, Betty sighed. Yes, Cindy pressed, but where she is right now, cleaning out the house and everything, she's in a place where she's probably thinking about basic things a little more. Betty pushed back. She says, Father Peel says, don't worry. And he's the smartest man, she says. Father Peel tells us not to worry. Pray and don't worry. I say, but Olga, that's Philippians 4, 6, and 7. And she just stares blankly and says, Dr. Peel, he's the one. And you know, it irritates me. It does. Cindy said to Betty, tell her she's safe with God. But Betty dug her heels in. She's taking everything away from God and handing it to Father Peel. He's really the one. Lene tried to lift Betty out of any responsibility for her difficult neighbor. She's stuck in her own way, isn't she? Betty's agitation broke as she confessed. She calls sometimes 3 times a day to tell me a cardinal is on the phone lines. Cindy said, she's really lonely, over the top of me as I exclaimed, wow, and Lene's touched cuddly. Ah. I shouldn't let her irritate me. I should be better than that, Betty said. Cindy continued to console Betty. Well, you're not yelling at her or anything, are you? She loves you. You give her time and you give her an ear. She must love me, Betty said. She bought me a Powerball ticket. But she made it really clear that if I won the $6 million, I had to share it with her. I was thankful to get to know Olga. I had never heard Betty talk about her before. But trying to move the discussion along, I asked, so after the interview, in terms of the direction of the congregation, what do you think we should be learning from that conversation? Betty looked to the ceiling and back to the group. Well, I want to say that I should talk more, but I tend to listen more. We're not supposed to belittle others' beliefs. That's what I want to do. Cindy said, but I think God has put you in this place to be a friend to her, and she's helping you reflect on what you believe. She stimulates you. She may not listen to you. She never does, Betty interjected to our laughter. Then I sensed something like a deep confirmation of what Cindy said next. God has put us in a place to be helpful. All you need to do is what you're doing. Lene's epigram was reassuring to failed preachers like Betty and me. She may not be listening to you, but she hears you. Lene continued saying, my person is Terry. Terry's a 37-year-old single mom of two, grew up Baptist but no church home, who lives in the apartments near me at Westlake where there are lots of crime, burglaries. And she said that she would feel more secure if there were more protection from the law. That way people would not feel so negative towards the cops. Lene followed up. That's about the apartment complex. What about at work? Terry said, Well, unity and loyalty and teamwork with the workers and 100% free insurance and better job security. I clarified, so police and insurance make us safe. Lene winked and continued. Then, on question 2 and 3, Terry referenced the same story. Last September, the Westlake Church of God offered services for single mothers. You brought your car in, and they gave you a free oil change, and they set up manicure booths, massages, breakfast, lunch, free child care, coffee and tea, and they offered to pray for people. They said nobody pressured you to join church, but you just made you feel comfortable. A lot of churches need to do something to pull people away from negative thoughts towards church. So, Terry feels churches are interested in people because they're selfishly wanting members, not because they want to be friends and to help the world. I was clarifying. I wasn't sure if Lene was still translating Terry or holding forth on her own when she continued. Well, many churches pressure them. Or more into what they're wearing rather than focusing on their soul. She feels pressure. Terry liked hearing about how church members just went out on the near north side the day to pray on the streets that have been so violent. Too often churches, they focus on money and they tell you what you would, that you just go to hell if you don't go to church. And I've experienced that myself. It's to the point where they talk about me so bad I never came back. At one point in time, I was really down and needed people to reach out to me. I understand this negative vibe towards churches. Cindy talked to Angie, and Cindy let us in on her excitement about the meeting. I saw Angie behind the alley with her dog, Coco. I knew she was very private, and I've lived there for over 2 years and have never been able to really get to know her, but I took a chance and I ran out there to ask if she would answer some questions. It would really only take about 5 minutes, and she said, okay. And the conversation turned out great. I found out she and her husband are in their 40s, they have a grown son, and they own the house behind us up the alley. She said she would feel more comfortable if the drug influence in the neighborhood was gone, but she said she feels comfortable mostly because she knows Ronald across the street and several others of the neighbors, and it made us both feel better that we can trust each other and count on one another a little bit. We did talk about the crime watch again. I interrupted to tell Lene and Betty that Cindy and her husband had been working on getting a crime watch started for the Alton neighborhood, when Betty said, "You need Olga, the one-woman crime watch." Cindy continued. Her best memory of church was when the former pastor of the Westlake Westside Ministry on Tibbs convinced her son that he needed the Lord. Her son was baptized 6 years ago, and she and her husband started going over there because of the attention they were paying to their son. We ought to go over there sometime when they are having something special. Lene loved it that we just go to other denominational services. She chimed in that she remembered a time when in her childhood when people in her community would just go out on the streets at night and neighbors would pray together on the streets. It reminds me of what Terry is appreciating. Cindy concurred. People down at Alton are still talking about our block party. In the weeks that followed our second meeting, the four of us had a hard time getting together, but I shared via email with Betty, Cindy, and Lene the manuscript of the story of our conversations together. I noted our collective concerns about security and how Olga, Terry, and Angie each exhibited in unique ways some of the fears permeating our society. I noted that each of the strangers served to minister to us. Olga clarified Betty's thinking. Terry rekindled Lene's childhood memory of the church praying with one another on the streets. Angie helped Cindy feel secure about the house behind her and introduced her to one of the small churches in her neighborhood. I asked the ladies to think about common themes in all of our conversations and what they thought about Betty, Cindy, Lene, Kent, Olga, Terry, and Angie. What all of that had to say and all of these people had to say about the missional direction of the Speedway Church. As we gathered in late March, Lene made an astonishing sacrifice to even be with the group. She would have to leave early to take a stress test, but told us that she really wanted to be present for as much of the conversation as possible. We spent some time listening to her talk about her children and their frustration not knowing about their father's illness. As we sat down praying for discernment with some pulled pork sandwiches at Betty's house, I asked Lene if she could just share her thoughts about what the conversations had meant for us. Lene thought my narrative of our conversation was funny, like a book. But she added that it was my story. It's mostly true. But it's what it meant to you. And what had it meant to her? Lene affirmed that we are a little out of our comfort zones and needed to do something that acknowledged the pressure people feel when they are thinking about churches. That's what I got out of Betty's relationship with Olga, Cindy said. It was then that Betty informed the group that Olga had left to live in hospice care near Columbus, Ohio. We sighed and were thankful for Betty's sustained neighborliness. Just being with people when they go through such things was what we all seemed to have a passion for and grief about. I clarified with Lene, do you think that Terry's skepticism about church is about churches being invitational? Do you think that people fear that we're there to get a big crowd at church rather than to be Christ's presence in their midst? What if our job was not to get them to come to church, but to be with them as people, just to be their friends, and to make the world a better place with their help? How much of the pressure they feel is the pressure we feel to invite them? Lene wasn't sure. At least there was a good way and a bad way to be invitational, I admitted. Lene expressed the gist of her thoughts about missional ministry for me. I don't think we need to do anything else. We just need to keep on doing what we're doing. It's kind of hard to get out of our comfort zones and to talk to people, but we don't need to do anything big. We just need to be with them. Betty then joined the conversation by telling the story of how she was frightened to come to a small church like ours, where she couldn't hide. When Betty came to Speedway 4 years ago, she said that she was so scared for weeks, but mysteriously she kept coming back. Betty felt uncomfortable being 71 and being invited repeatedly by a 17-year-old, but she was thankful that people understood her need for friendliness and also space. It was her first church dinner that really ushered her into a sense of belonging. Had we overwhelmed her before that important dinner day, she would probably have left. She expressed previous experiences with exclusivity bound up in cultures of pride and shame, and she found the simple relationships to be so important at Speedway. Betty, like Lene, felt that we were experiencing growth by simply being in relationship. I decided at that point I needed to be more directive in this meeting, and I decided to share with the ladies the church leadership's idea of buying a big cooker that could grill large amounts of meat this summer, and we wanted to make our fellowship meals both on Sunday nights and on Sunday dinner days more of a missional practice, more like our Thanksgiving meals, by having the meals in the parks and on Alton Street, a kind of version of Cindy's block party. Cindy said, if we did something like that, We'd have to keep it up because I know people will be very afraid to do that, eat with us. I've tried it before. And I ask, what if we told them we're not inviting people to church, but maybe just raising awareness of the new crime watch? Cindy insisted. But we have to keep it up. We might not have but a few people. I'm just starting to have conversations with people, and it's taken me 3 years. I agree, I said. It'll probably take 6 or 7 years until folks down there really trust you to help. But what is success for us? We aren't interested in a big crowd. We couldn't minister to 30 new people if we got them. Success is meeting a new person and loving them at that moment. Doesn't that help them feel safe, like you and Angie feel safe after you spoke together? Maybe that, Cindy, is the goal. Cindy said, I've been reading that book, Slow Church, a thought-provoking book by Chris Smith, who had spoken at Speedway last month. And I'm having a hard time with it, but I think it's the kind of thing we do. I think that not having that initial time with Jerry is where we failed her. Jerry Maines was an inmate at the Indiana Women's Prison that we had invited to stay in one of our Alton houses. She was forced by the system to go 3 hours away, and we were not able to develop a relationship with her that could sustain us through the transitions in her reentry. Yes, I said, just think. In the last month, we've had 3 couples decide to be part of Speedway. In one way, we had nothing to do with it. They just came. But if you think about it, we cared for Sylvia for years and bragged on her to her family at family events and funerals. Sylvia was such a ministry to my family when Dan, my father-in-law, died, that she came to see herself as an important minister among us. And now Sylvia's just an invitational machine, and her grandchildren, Tabitha and Gerald, seem to love us. Rosa and Noah, they came to us after my wife Amy has worked and prayed and encouraged Rosa for 3 years, and Amy never invited her to church at all. They came despite the fear for a lot of other reasons. Allie and Jonathan came to us because we practically raised Allie for over a dozen years. Now, I hope that she's back for good. Real growth may be more about strengthening our back for a long commitment with and for people, with no expectation of reward, not any quick invitational pressure. We all got up and gave Lene hugs as she left. Her assessment was that we needed to keep pushing ourselves to relate to more people in our setting, but not do anything remarkably different. The remaining 3 of us started dwelling in the Word in Luke 10, 1 through 11, one more time. This time, through the text, Cindy and Betty were again attending to many of the details which they continued to wrestle with, and I had a hard time trying to get them to center on one phrase or word, but one particular exchange between Betty and myself struck me as significant. Betty read aloud, "Wipe the dust off your feet." When do we know when to give up on people? I paused and responded, "Well, if you're asking to stay at their house and asking them to help you and they refuse, then you don't force yourself on them and try to break into their house." But I think part of our problem with this text is that we try to force it into our invitational or attractional church mold. The question then becomes, when do we stop pressuring them to come to church? Yes, that Betty nodded. And I continued, "But if, Betty, if we're going seeking their help and they don't want to give it, we just take the party somewhere else. If they don't invite us to come into their space, we We know immediately that we have to move on, but this shift in thinking about going to others and depending on them rather than inviting them to us is really a hard change to get our minds around. I wonder, I later asked Betty, if we had a dinner over here at Meadowood Park, do you think there would be any people who would come and take a free meal to someone who had lost a loved one or who would enjoy not having to do the cooking? You know, invite them to help us help people that they know? This got her to thinking about her son Bob. The wheels began to turn. I could see it in her eyes. Cindy, like Betty, did not have specific suggestions about things to do, but said that she felt that the important thing that came out of the conversation this final evening of our discernment group was that we just need to model for more and more of our members, who might not be on board with all this being sent stuff. We just need to model the courage to be in conversation with our neighbors. I think we just need to keep on doing that. Jesus taught us to have conversations with strangers. Nay, to go into their homes with them. All the things my ladies were taught not to do as children. Missionaries need constant assurance of God's protection over his lambs. And that need for safety is felt just as powerfully by our strangers. Terry, longing for more police and free insurance. Angie, afraid to make a new friend of Cindy. Olga, afraid of dying alone. All of them suspicious. Actually, terrified of institutions that shame people. Particularly churches with church marketing agendas that pressure them. Who seek not to love them, but to sell them. To make them consumers of their religious brand. Time and again they've been burned, and they've been left in modernity's loneliness. Friendliness alone will not break down these fearful defenses. It will take the exciting work of God, which convinced the disciples upon returning from their first foray into mission, that even the demons submit to us. In that hope, my ladies and I are beginning to feel, as well as to say that the church exists for the world, not for its own institutional survival or for its members' insular comfort. The liturgical life of the church rather propels us into more and more conversations with strangers, for the stranger's own sake. People who just need a new network of friends. Mission for my ladies is not a big program. Even the small ones we engage in, like the after-school art program, depend on relationships with the school administration, parents, and of course the rowdy children. It's all about entering into Olga's cancer diagnosis, cantankerous as Olga may be. Conversation leads us to a place of mercy that triumphs over our moralistic judgments that are so easy for us to hold if we stay away and hold them from afar. Conversations with strangers help us hear ourselves through the ears of someone who doesn't share our prejudice. We may know what we mean, but it often takes a stranger to tell us what we're actually saying. The church leadership at Speedway has even started paying strangers, both churched and unchurched strangers, to sit through our services and provide us feedback. Conversations with strangers clarify for us what we believe by forcing us to articulate with Betty the faith in new contexts. They are conversations that confront us with our own impatience and invite us to contentment with simply being Christ's presence to the other, like Jesus in and with the world. Conversations with strangers, especially over food if we can arrange it, seem to diffuse our fears like they did with Betty and like they did at the block party Cindy sponsored. These conversations mitigate our loneliness and make us and those around us more secure. If we can find God's courage to start talking. Our group came together and confessed that we were afraid. We discerned that. People, I'm realizing, are everywhere more afraid than what I thought. And that is one reason our group decided that we must push ourselves to speak into outer, other space.